AM 950, the progressive voice of Minnesota. Brett Johnson with you here on a Tuesday afternoon. And today we are joined by the editor-in-chief of the Minnesota Reformer. That's Patrick Coulihan. Learn more about the Minnesota Reformer at minnesotareformer.com for the latest in Minnesota news and politics. As today we're going to be focused on some, call it budget issues. Now, normally that would sound pretty dry, but what we're talking about today, I think, is going to be pretty interesting because it's going to have an impact on a lot of Minnesotans, especially if you're someone who uses Uber and Lyft. In fact, we'll be starting off there today with Patrick talking about his column that highlights what's been happening with Uber and Lyft in Minneapolis. We'll also be talking a little bit about the state budget as well. Patrick, thanks so much for coming back on the show today.
Always a pleasure.
Absolutely. So let's start off talking about Uber and Lyft, because Minneapolis Uber and Lyft drivers look like they are set to get a pay raise beginning on May 1st. That's because last week the Minneapolis City Council voted by a 10-3 margin to override a veto from Jacob Fry that sets a minimum pay rate for drivers. Uber now says they are going to leave the entire Twin Cities on May 1st, while Lyft says they will cut service in Minneapolis. Now, it does seem like everyone, in terms of lawmakers, agrees that the rates for Uber and Lyft drivers need to be raised, but by how much is the question? The city council is basing their idea, which says that they are going to pay drivers $1.40 per mile and 51 cents per minute, are what's required to help drivers maintain the city's minimum wage of $15.57. So again, that's $1.40 per mile and 51 cents per minute. But there was another report released by the state which showed that the rates only needed to be $1.20 per mile and 49 cents per minute. That would allow drivers to be able to meet their minimum requirements and the minimum wage in Minneapolis. So there's lots to unpack here, including the difference between these two reports. And let's start off there talking about the difference between these reports, because initially when I saw there, I see one report that's saying we need a higher minimum wage and one the other, I originally thought, well, this one from that's proposing a lower wage probably is coming from some industry-friendly reporter. But it turns out these are both very labor-friendly reports, but there's certainly a big methodology difference in terms of, well, how both of these numbers were arrived at. And that's kind of the crux of the issue in terms of why we're having this debate about setting these pay rates for Uber and Lyft drivers.
Yeah, I think that first thing to note was that the city council passed their ordinance the day before this big state report came out. And the council knew that it was coming out. And let me highlight the quality of that state report. It includes an analysis of more than 18 million rides that all Minnesotans took in 2022 with Uber and Lyft. It's the first kind of report of its kind. So a massive amount of data. And you know, I think anybody who's an advocate of good government would say that's a little bit questionable when the council knew that this big state report that we've all been waiting for 6 months, really. We've been waiting for it. It's coming out on a Friday. They knew it was coming out. It's curious to me that they went ahead anyway and passed their own ordinance. And as you said, there are differences between the city report they ordered up. It just doesn't have the range of data that the state Department of Labor has. I should also note that the state, the Department of Labor and Industry, the report they commissioned, these two economists, one from the New School, one from University of California, Berkeley. These are labor-friendly guys. I'm working on a column now, and I noticed that they wrote a commentary for the New York Daily News that endorsed New York City's driver pay ordinance. So it's not like these guys are some company hacks. If you read the report, I mean, it's pretty detailed and extensive. And I think it's also worth noting that the company's attacked their report. So I certainly wish, and I think a lot of people wish, that the city council had just waited. But it sure looks to me like they wanted to go ahead no matter what the data showed. They had some numbers in mind, and that's what they were going to go with. So that's sort of and I think, like you said, people say, oh, there's one report, then there's another report. I think this is the problem here, is that the waters are kind of muddied, but if you actually spend some time with both reports, you see that the state version, it's quite a bit different. And but the problem is now, if we wanted to get some kind of compromise at the legislature, because I think that the lower figures of that are offered in the state report that would be needed for a minimum wage, I think the companies could live with those, with that figure. The problem is that the legislature is unlikely to want to preempt Minneapolis. You're just not going to have, it's going to be very difficult to get Minneapolis lawmakers at the legislature to override the city council. They're just not going to want to do that politically. And Tim Walz is sort of like the governor had flirted with that idea, but I think he probably got some blowback when he even suggested that was a possibility, and he kind of walked that back yesterday. So it seems like for now, this Minneapolis ordinance is in place, and the companies say that they're going to leave. Now, they could be bluffing. That wouldn't be the first time a corporation had not liked a potential policy and tried to bluff. But they also now, I think that, if and when they're faced with this kind of lobbying challenge in other places, if they do wind up bluffing, it's going to be bad for their credibility. And so they have quite a bit of motivation to follow through on the threat. Now, if and when they do follow through on the threat, now, what do we do about the 3 million airport rides that Uber and Lyft drivers managed in 2022? And we can probably, it's probably a greater number now because air traffic is, of course, increasing back to pre-pandemic levels. I'm not really sure that we have what it takes to move those people from the airport to the Twin Cities. And that's really just the start of the issues that have arisen here. So, I think that it's reasonable for us to expect Uber and Lyft to pay drivers better and more specifically Uber and Lyft's customers. And we ought to have a pay floor. The question is, how do you do it? How do you do it without crushing demand? Because we're talking about 10,000 drivers here. If Uber and Lyft leave, that's 10,000 people who have to find a different job. Or if the rates are so high that they wind up increasing prices a lot, and we're just not going to see as much. People will just not be taking Uber and Lyft as much. So there's a lot of nuance. There's some policy. There's some risks and benefits to balance out here. And that's not really what's happening, unfortunately, I don't think. I think it's we're kind of using a sledgehammer here, and I'm a little concerned about the consequences here in a couple months when it takes effect, actually May 1st.
Well, I think it's important to point out that Uber and Lyft are probably, when we brought up the example how Uber and Lyft largely trashed these reports that we saw from New York City when they were trying to raise their own rates. And now we see here in Minnesota that we have conflicting reports right now from that state report and then the local city report. This does seem to be playing very much into the hands of Uber and Lyft, where they can generally encourage people to say, well, throw up your hands. We don't know which report is right. Let's just stick with the status quo so you can keep getting your rides to the airport and keep getting rides around town. So this largely does kind of play into their hands to have this kind of dispute right now, because for them, that would be the ideal situation, just to stick with the status quo, because I think as you're going to bring up in your column, Uber has negotiated with other cities before, New York City, Seattle, and remained active with their service, even though they've had their pay rates increase. So they are willing to negotiate, but this is kind of playing right into their hands when we have these conflicting reports and conflicting philosophies from the state legislature and the city council, where it could be very easy where both sides are going to reach a stalemate and nothing's going to happen at all.
Well, maybe, but Minneapolis has now. This is going to be law.
Law, yeah. It could be. Yeah, preempted by that. Yeah.
So, we're not dealing with the status quo anymore. Mm-hmm. The ordinance is going to take effect. These are going to be the minimum rates, and if you believe them, You're not going to be able to get an Uber or a Lyft in Minneapolis on May 1st. Now, again, they could be bluffing, and it wouldn't be totally surprising. And, of course, there's mass transit, and there's other companies that have said that they would step in. I don't think that they could scale up, given, you know, we're talking about 18 million rides. That's a lot of transport. And then the other issue I should also note is that there's essentially no taxi industry anymore. There's only a handful of licensed taxi drivers at all. And even when there was one, apparently it was people complained about it. It was not very great. So we can argue about Uber and Lyft and how they drove the taxi industry out of business. There was a certain lawlessness to the way Uber and Lyft became to dominate local transport. There's no question about that. They're probably exploiting drivers. They got along forever with very cheap fares because they're getting all this cheap investor money, you know, when interest rates were low and investors were looking, would throw money at tech companies like this just to give them money to scale up without having any profits. I'm not trying to make Uber and Lyft out to be heroic by any means. Mm-hmm. But the reality is that here they are. There's 10,000 people who rely on Uber and Lyft for income. There's 22 million rides, or excuse me, 18 million rides, more than 18 million rides in 2022 alone. And if they do pack up and leave, there will be consequences. It's not going to be the end of the world. I think somebody wrote last week that, you know, Minneapolis was a fine city before Uber and Lyft, and I don't think that nobody would argue with that. But I think it's a little short-sighted to pretend that there's not going to be consequences to this decision.
Yeah, when it comes to the idea of bringing in replacement companies, there certainly would be some that would be interested in coming in and filling that void of Uber and Lyft, but it would just be, as you've said, trying to get to that, to scaling up to the level of service that they would need to be able to fulfill that demand, because as you said, it would be enormous for any one company or even just a handful of companies to try to fill that void that could be there if Uber and Lyft both leave, at least in the short term for the first couple of years. Maybe in a few years they could fill that void, but there would be some problems, at least in the short term, and there are a lot of people who use that for going to the airport or just getting around town and so forth.
Yeah, I mean, I had somebody tell me last week that, all it is an app on a phone and that can be replaced easily. I think that probably underestimates the technology involved with Uber and Lyft. And again, I'm not trying to say that these are great humanitarians here running these companies, but they do provide a service, and if that service goes away, then people are going to have to figure out what to do in their absence.
I think ultimately the crux of your column is before we make these big policy decisions, as the Minneapolis City Council did with passing these new rates for Uber drivers, let's make sure we have all of the data, because that does strike me as being not the best idea to decide to pass these rates and override Jacob Frey's veto the day before that state report comes out, which showed different rates. I like the analogy I think you threw in the column, talking about how this would be the equivalent of Republicans passing this big tax cut bill the day before a report would be released that would show the impacts of what those tax cuts would have on the budget and the economy at large. I think it's the crux of it is, let's make sure we have all the data before we make these big time policy decisions.
Yeah. I mean, I think that whenever we see somebody messing around with data or deliberately making decisions, in this case, the day before the state report comes out, I think we really have to question why it is they're doing that, and whether or not they're acting in good faith, unfortunately. And so that was certainly my concern. And remember, they passed the ordinance the day before the report came out. They overrode the ordinance with that data in hand. They rejected the state report out of hand, and even though it was again, compiled by these two researchers who are labor friendly and attend and have a lot of experience in this area. They've done a lot of academic research on Uber and Lyft, both on the wages and the expense side. So I think it was probably a mistake to just ignore that data analysis.
Read more about that column, which I believe you can find probably tomorrow over at the Reformer, over MinnesotaReformer.com, MinnesotaReformer.com, getting some facts about what's happening here with Uber and Lyft and the fact that their rates are going up in May 1st, but there's always the threat of being possibly preempted by the state and then Uber and Lyft threatening to leave. So there's still lots more to follow along with this story as it develops, especially as we approach that May 1st date when rates are going to go up in Minneapolis for Uber and Lyft drivers. One more story to touch on, and this has to do with more budget issues, but this time at the state level. Because last year, Governor Tim Walz and the Minnesota State Legislature passed a $72 billion budget. Now, this year, Walz released a plan which would call for about $250 million in new spending, which is very modest considering that we have the $72 billion budget, and probably more modest than people might have been expecting. The state budget agency is projecting about a $3.7 billion surplus, but with Walz's budget, we would be able to sit on about $2 million of reserves. So I'm curious, what struck you about this Governor Tim Walz budget? Was it necessarily the size and kind of the lack of spending considering the surplus we have? Or what jumped out at you, at least what you've seen from Governor's initial budget this year?
I've had a previous conversation with a DFL source of mine who had a good analogy for the what it's kind of felt like after last year's session. That was he compared it to going on a really good bender, and the feeling of you know, it was fun. And, I don't really remember all of it so well, but it seems like we had a great time, and I feel, you know, have a little bit of a hangover, tiniest bit of shame. So, I mean, you know, I'm joking. You know, that budget achieved a lot of policy goals, and we'll hopefully see that all that play out in the next few years. But I do think there's a sense amongst DFL folks, some of them, Governor Walz included, and I think that Speaker Melissa Hortman as well. It's her chamber that is standing for re-election this year. The Senate's not on the ballot, and they have a pretty slender majority. It's currently 70-60. It'll be 70-64 after a special election today. And so, you know, I don't think they want to give the drunken sailor vibes to voters, especially in some of those maybe second, third ring suburbs where they have to defend seats to keep that majority. So, yeah, it's a pretty slender slender supplemental budget. And despite a pretty significant wish list on the part of the legislature, it's pretty bare bones, and it's the legislature ultimately who they get to make these decisions, and Walz is probably not going to veto something, I don't think, and so they get to make the decisions, but he certainly has created a very a pretty slender skeletal structure blueprint for his supplemental budget.
And where I was going to go next on this is, let's say the legislature and Walz aren't able to reach an agreement. Right now, it's only the state house that's going to be facing re-election here in the 2024 cycle, as, of course, Governor Walz and the state Senate are not up for re-election. So you wonder if that might maybe give at least the house a little more leverage and the state legislature as a whole a little more leverage when they can say, well, we're the ones facing re-election here, Governor Walz. We can't really afford to have you veto these bills because, well, we need to get these passed to help some of our lawmakers who are facing tough re-election battles. So do you wonder if that could possibly play a role? Of course, with the state house now facing re-election, where maybe they have a little more leverage if there's negotiations with Governor Walz coming up?
Yeah, I mean, I don't see him He can be kind of conflict averse, so I don't really see him vetoing any package that comes over from the from a DFL-controlled legislature. I think that's highly unlikely. I think he's just going to have to try to dissuade them from going real big this year. But the reality is that there's very influential progressives in both caucuses and in the advocacy groups, and they've got. No, they think they were last year, as ambitious as it was, did not include enough, they think, for child care. And certainly on education, you know, there was a big increase, but there was tied up in some pretty expensive mandates. And so that's where you have a number of school districts who say, despite the increase, they're struggling. I don't, you know, the speaker and the governor are powerful, influential people, but ultimately it's the two caucuses are going to make this decision, and the progressives have a lot more numbers and influence in both the House and Senate DFL caucuses than they did even 5 years ago. So I think it's going to be interesting to see how it plays out.
Well, we'll have to leave it there as we are just about out of time, but you can read more about the budget that was proposed by Governor Tim Walz and maybe some of the differences between that and what the state legislature is asking for over at MinnesotaReformer.com. And make sure you read about Patrick's column on Uber and Lyft as well over at MinnesotaReformer.com. We have been speaking with Patrick Houlihan of the Minnesota Reformer. As always, thanks for coming on the show today. Appreciate it.
Thank you. Good to be here.
All right, let's take a break and send things back over to Matt McNeil on AM 950.